Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, our own community radio station, still on the air at 90.7 on your radio dial. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Before I go any further, I want to remind everyone that KBOO is in the middle of our fall drive. And yes, community radio means listener-powered radio and no corporate sponsors. Community radio means democracy in action, and our theme for this drive is the sounds of democracy. If you want to help keep community radio alive in Portland and support our democratic yearnings, you can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking on Donate in our mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or sending a check by snail mail to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. To sweeten the pot, every donor during the drive will be eligible to win a print of a photo by camera activist Betty Lee, who has spent 30 years documenting righteous resistance in the streets of Portland. In this drawing, sponsored by the Old Mole Variety Hour, two lucky donors will be selected for the photo giveaway. You do not need to be present to win. All you need to do is donate. To see the selection of fabulous photos by Betty Lee, visit kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Today on our show, we examine some of the most pressing social and economic issues of our time. Bookmole Larry Bolden reviews an important and heartbreaking novel about female domestic workers of the Global South who are forced to leave their families in order to provide for them. Jan Hocken interviews a Baptist pastor and progressive theologian about the religious right in the U.S., the anti-racist history of the American Baptist Church, and the contributions of the Black Church. We'll follow that with a brief clip of Reverend Jesse Jackson on Martin Luther King's vision of multiracial organizing. Our music selections today are by Madeline Peru, singer and songwriter, who sings achingly about life on the skids. First up, we have Bill Resnick with longtime California climate activist Al Weinreb. The United States, and indeed the entire globe, is at a critical crossroads. Either we let the purveyors of corporate energy systems have their way with us, with their plan for huge sun and wind farms and nuclear plants in remote areas connected to users by enormously expensive continent-spanning grids, or we begin to build out an energy system that is local, democratically controlled, green, and might possibly save us from climate catastrophe. Here's Bill.
Al Weinreb, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill.
Al Weinreb started out as a physicist and began doing social justice work early on, recognized the dangers of global warming, left an academic career to become a community organizer, not just warning us, but building movements that could lead the reconstruction necessary to save us from unimaginable catastrophe on an uninhabitable planet. To that aim, he's been the coordinator of the local Clean Energy Alliance in the Bay Area for close to a dozen years. Also wrote the classic book, Community Power, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California, and co-edited the book, Energy Democracy. So, Alan, this year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its sixth assessment report with a very dire warning that we, humanity, have 10 years to reconfigure our economies and ways of life, especially in the developed economies, 10 years to save ourselves from the catastrophic climate change. You have thought about this a lot and worked in it. What's our best chance of avoiding the mass suffering and death, maybe even human extinction?
That's a very big question. It starts from, like, where this whole crisis has come from, clearly out of an economic system, you know, that's been a very extractive and very exploitive since it came on. And we call that system capitalism, and the way it uses the resources of the earth and the people of the earth in order to build and concentrate capital, and the power of a small group of people who have then used fossil fuel energy resources as an important driver of that kind of activity and that kind of economic system, and constructed, you know, whole societies around the use of fossil fuel as an energy source for driving the economy and every other aspect of life. And we've seen now the contradictions coming, as Malcolm X said, the chickens coming home to roost, where now we are faced with an existential threat to the survival of the Earth's ecosystem and all the species that depend on that ecosystem, including the human race itself. At a deeper level, it definitely requires us to think about the whole economic system and how it's structured, more immediately about energy resources and those energy resources that are being used. And it doesn't take too much of a grasp of the situation to understand that fossil fuel extraction and use has to disappear in favor of renewable energy resources. That much is very clear, but that doesn't say too much about the nature of the struggle, because the struggle is not a technical struggle, really. It's a struggle about very powerful economic and political forces. But most people get, and there's been a whole movement created, a climate movement, around this transition from a fossil fuel economy or a fossil fuel energy base to a renewable energy base. Most of my work is involved not in that question so much, but trying to look at, okay, well, if there is a transition, if we are going to move toward renewable sources of energy, what does that solution space look like? What do we imagine that to be, especially since technologically it's really easy to understand what needs to be done because the technologies are all around. But then what does that look like? What are the set of institutions within which renewable energy has to develop in a way to really address the climate crisis? That's a question that I think is more on the agenda today, but hasn't been that much on the agenda. The problem has been defined as a technological problem of moving from fossil fuel power to renewable energy. But that's problematic in itself, that framework, because, as I mentioned before, the real problem isn't technological. The real question is, well, okay, under what conditions and under whose control will renewable energy be developed in order to supplant fossil fuel energy? That's a question that the movement has not really taken up and grappled with. So even now, you see all these calls for a transition to 100% renewable energy. We need to have climate action plans. But what does that actually look like? And by default, it looks like the fossil fuel energy system. You just stick in a little bit of renewable energy for the fossil fuel energy, and everything else is the same. Same institutions, the same power structure, the same everything. So when we're talking about a transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, we're really talking about a transition from the large oil corporations and their economic interests to a transition to the large utility interests and the Wall Street backers and large transmission companies and establishment that's associated with utilities. Nothing new about it. We go from nuclear plants and coal-fired power plants and gas-fired power plants to solar and wind plantations, remote and distant from people, where the electricity is carried across large high-voltage transmission lines to where it's got to be used. And that energy system we call a centralized energy model, because it's centralized in the sense that the energy generation is concentrated in very large facilities that are remote from where people generally live, although a lot of gas-fired power plants and electricity power plants are in neighborhoods. That's a big environmental justice question and has resulted in poisoning of large sectors of our communities, low-income people. And the decisions made about this whole energy structure are made out of Wall Street and the banks and large corporate enterprise. And that's the model that we've had in California for a very long time and in most places. Mostly states have energy systems that are dominated by large monopoly utilities whose energy model is a centralized energy model.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Al Weinrub, a physicist turned community organizer to build movements that must stop the global warming that threatens the human future. He co-founded the Local Clean Energy Alliance of the Bay Area, also wrote the classic book Community Power, distributed renewable energy in California, and co-edited the book Energy Democracy. We just discussed the corporate model of moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy. But there is an alternative to the big utility model and the immense costs of the grid. there is a different model that's being talked about a lot in scientific circles, not enough in community circles, but in fact, the community energy movement is emerging much stronger. In fact, in Biden's plans, he began just talking about the big grid. In time, he's been forced, I think, by Bernie Sanders and the Green New Deal people, and they need their support in the Congress. There is a progressive caucus, after all. He's been, in fact, forced in some of his latest Build Back Better program and the other infrastructure program. They've also talked about funding community energy and distributed energy. It seems to me there really is an alternative, and you know that alternative a whole lot better than almost anybody else on Earth, and how it's, in fact, being degraded in some places. Tell us about the alternative.
So two aspects of the centralized energy model in terms of what it means about climate change. The first, as you pointed out, is that the whole model is based on remote energy and large transmission lines. And what we know from climate change is that it creates conditions where this becomes a very vulnerable and risky electricity system. We know in California, for example, that the utilities, these outmoded and dilapidated transmission infrastructure has caused a lot of the wildfires. These wildfires are very destructive. They kill people, they destroy property, and those are all costs that are borne by our citizens. So the first thing about the centralized energy model is that it's the worst model to use under climate change conditions because the weather and the climate make this a very vulnerable electricity system. The second thing that's really important is that the impacts of this destruction are borne mostly by low-income people and people of color. So built into this centralized energy model is actually what we call institutionalized racism. The impacts of this model is like everything else about climate change. The people who are worst impacted and most harmed by the fossil fuel energy system are the same people that are most harmed by this centralized renewable energy model. That model is just a model that accentuates the racial divide and at the same time puts everybody else in jeopardy as well. So when we talk about a decentralized energy model, I mean, that's what we're trying to address, is the total failure of the centralized energy model when it comes to any real alternative from the point of view of an energy model that will help strengthen our society, strengthen our communities, address the racial disparities that have existed and are very strong within the energy model. I mean, we know because of fossil fuel who is most poisoned and most harmed by fossil fuel energy. But what I'm pointing out is the centralized energy model sort of reproduces that whole same effect. So the alternative is made possible by the very nature of renewable energy itself. It's the sun shines everywhere, the wind blows everywhere, ability to save energy and to cut back on energy use exists everywhere. These are what we call distributed energy resources. They're resources that can be harnessed and used everywhere. They can be harnessed locally. So you can build solar electricity generation through solar locally. You can cut energy use by being smart and not wasting energy locally. Wind is harder to use locally, but it's still things like geothermal and wind are better harnessed at times and wherever those resources exist. So in general, the whole idea of renewable energy is a distributed resource. It has many forms and ways of handling it, but it can all be developed locally. And that gives rise to the possibility of what we call a decentralized energy model, where all the aspects of the centralized energy model can be turned on their head. Instead of having very large banks and very large institutions making the decisions about what kind of resources to develop, when and where, these can be made by the community itself. Where investments go and who they benefit can be made by the community itself. They can create local investments, they create local jobs, they create economic expansion for small businesses and so on. Dealing with questions of inequities, those programs can be shaped to meet the needs of the communities that they're supposed to be served. So this is what we call a decentralized energy model. And this model has actually been around for a number of years. More recognizably, you know, you can put solar on your home or you can put solar on your schools or churches or on your businesses. That is a form of distributed energy and is an important aspect of a decentralized energy model. So I think if you're really looking for an energy model that's more democratized, that is more sustainable, more equitable from a point of social justice, we're talking about resources that get developed and decided upon locally and institutions that will help promote that.
Yeah, there's another aspect of the disaster that will be caused by the corporate banker investor-owned utility model that really shifts resources to the rich. Investors in those companies also do very, very well at 10% earnings. The banks do well on it, underwriting their debt, everything. I mean, it's a vast rent on everybody else. But the other aspect is we're in a race with time now. Unless we develop a clean energy system and begin reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we have 10 years, they're never going to be able to develop their system in 10 years. It's extremely both expensive and shutting up these continent-spanning grids. They're not only expensive, they take time to design. They take a huge amount of time to build. They take singular designs in every area. And on top of it, that system is only as reliable as their most vulnerable pylon or plant. It seems to me that that system is completely unable to actually produce kinds of reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that are absolutely necessary. They cannot do it in 10 years or even 20 years, no matter what they did, even if they were immunized from every environmental regulation, which is what they're also looking for. It seems to me renewable energy can be built in a city by any construction company who can build a house or a kitchen even. It's a very simple technology. It's of off-the-shelf materials that people can be trained to use very quickly. And it seems to me that their system is a recipe for the destruction of the planet. Anyway, that's my pitch. Al Weinrub, there's been lots of efforts, including in California, to do community solar and wind, to build out the local structures, to confederate with other cities and towns in the region for storage and for resilience and for repair facilities and storage in particular. It seems to me that we even have the models for doing it, but unfortunately, they're really under attack. Give us a little more detail about the models, and then we can talk about the attacks that are going on and the way to counter the attacks. And it seems to me that humanity is not going to have a future under the corporate model. Tell us about the local struggles and what local energy could look like.
Yeah, so this notion that I'm putting forward about a decentralized energy model is not that new in concept. I mean, it makes so much logical sense, even because the technology so directly lends itself to that. But as I mentioned before, that the question of a transition from fossil fuel to renewable energy economy is really not a question of technology. It's a question of political forces and political power. And so the centralized electricity model that we're talking about, again, is a power structure deeply embedded in our states and in our communities. And so the effort to move toward decentralized energy is basically a political and economic struggle, because the establishment is, just like the fossil fuel industry, is opposed to that kind of transition.
Here I am awake in a wilderness of lies, trying to assemble a suitable disguise, bleary-eyed and seeking signs I recognize, someone I can count on to be there as my guide. All my heroes were failures in their eyes, losers, drunkards, fallen saints, and suicides. I feel a fever break underneath my...
That was Madeline Peru with a clip from her song entitled All My Heroes. Before that, Bill was talking with Al Weinrub in the first of a two-part discussion about the emerging struggle over the future of our energy system, a battle that could well decide the future of our species. Next week, we'll air part two of the interview, which includes how the investor-owned utilities are trying to stifle the development of local sun and wind energy generation while building out their own hugely expensive system. We'll also hear how the left can mobilize to expand locally produced energy. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, which is now 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country. We're still going strong because of listeners like you. If you're already a monthly contributor, consider increasing your monthly contribution. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, by clicking on Donate in our mobile app, by texting KBOO to 44321, or sending a check by snail mail, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Remember, two lucky donors will win a print of one of Betty Lee's photos. And thanks to everyone who has already given so generously. All over the global South, but especially in parts of Asia, impoverished mothers make the difficult decision to leave their children behind to seek domestic work in wealthier nations as the only option left to them to support their families. These are women who are misunderstood, exploited, and sometimes much worse. Larry Bolden reviews a novel published this year which seeks to make the lives of these women visible. As always, in these pandemic times, I will read Larry's review for him. Today, I want to talk to you about a 2021 novel by Christy Lefteri entitled Songbirds. The book is both wonderful and awful. Wonderful in the original meaning of the word, that is, full of wonder. But awful, not in the sense of full of awe, but rather the more pedestrian meaning of horrible or ghastly. Originally, I put the book down after only a few pages describing the practice of catching, killing, and eating songbirds, sickened by the very clear description. Fortunately, another reader in a small group of readers I belong to texted me to recommend Songbirds. So I picked it up again, and this time stayed with it. I'm so glad I did. Christy Lefteri is the child of Cypriot refugees and was brought up in London. She tells us in the author's note at the end of the book that she became friends with a domestic worker in Cyprus, whom she refers to simply as Kay. Kay has left her own daughters in Sri Lanka to work as a domestic worker in order to provide for her children. Quote, "She sends them clothes and money, but she cannot be there with them as they grow into young adults. I could see the strength, resilience, and immense love that Kay had within her, but I also came to see the immense suffering of her sacrifice. In the meantime, I could see how the other women in all the households along that street went about their duties, often unseen and misunderstood. Ah, one of the neighbors said to me once, these women don't care about their families. They drift around the world." End quote. Lefteri reminds the reader that these refugees are not like migrants. They leave home because they have no choice. Although not long, this little novel is complex and tells several stories at once. On one level, it is simply a love story. Yanis is a poacher who falls in love with Nisha, a domestic worker from Sri Lanka who works for his landlady, Petra, as cook, cleaner, and childminder for her 9-year-old daughter, Aliki. Aliki is a precocious and imaginative child, and her relationship with her mother, with Nisha, and with Yanis are lighthearted and lovely. On another level, it is a brutal story of men like Yanis who illegally poach protected songbirds, selling them to restaurants and rich patrons who eat the birds as a kind of delicacy. Two boats go out on the water with a mist net strung between them, quote, "almost invisibly, just above the sea," end quote. Yanis works for another man, Seraphim, who in turn works for wealthy financial backers. The boat goes out in the dark of night and waits for daybreak. Quote, I must have fallen asleep because when I woke up, I saw 1,000 wings silhouetted against the sky, the sun cracking through the edge of the world. The birds that flew highest missed the net and made it to the shore. The others, the hundreds that skimmed the water or flew a few meters above it, their journeys ended there. They crashed into an invisible barrier, the fine threads of our massive net, and there they would flap, screech, and cry, but there they would stay. End quote. On other hunts, they take calling birds that have been kept in the dark for days or weeks so that when the covers are removed, they sing constantly, calling the free birds to them and the traps. While the descriptions of the poaching are horrendous, there are mercifully few pages of such description, while the story of Nisha and Aliki is lovely and beautifully told. Suddenly, and without any notice or note, Nisha disappears, leaving her passport and personal items that she would never travel without. And so opens another level of the story. What has happened to Nisha? And why do the authorities ignore the missing person report filed both by Petra and Giannis? Quote, I was wondering if you could take down Nisha's details, investigate. I can't concern myself with these foreign women. I have more important matters to attend to. If she doesn't return, my guess would be that she's run away to the north. That's what they do. She's gone to the Turkish side to find better employment. These women are animals. They follow their instincts. Or the money, more likely. That's what I have to say on the matter. End quote. Since neither Petra nor Giannis get any help from the police or authorities, they begin an investigation of their own into Nisha's disappearance. Eventually, they discover that 4 other women domestic workers have disappeared, 2 of them with children, who have also disappeared. Lefteri tells us in her author's note that the novel was inspired partly by the disappearance of 5 female migrant domestic workers in Cyprus, along with 2 of their children. The comparison of the poached songbirds caught in the mist net to the refugee workers is a powerful one, and Lefteri's beautiful writing provides a rich backdrop for her story. I have neither the time nor the inclination to tell readers how this story ends, but I can say that this is a book that we should all read. I will close with one more quote from the author's endnote. Quote, Songbirds is a story about migration and crossing borders. It is about searching for freedom, for a better life, only to find oneself trapped. It is a story about the ways in which systemic racism exists, often unquestioned, relying upon prejudice and nationalistic ideas to survive. It is a story about learning to see each other and every human being in the same way we see ourselves. End quote. This is Patricia Kohlberg reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Job's gone missing, insurance is a fail, credit cards stop coming, my attorney's in jail. I just broke a law I never heard of before. Landlord thinks I'm made and he busts down my door. You should think I was pretty damn smart. Smart enough to see I'm falling apart. I keep going down, down,
That bit of music is from a song entitled Going Down, again by singer-songwriter Madeline Peyrou. To close our show, Jan Hawkins speaks with Baptist pastor, progressive theologian, author, and educator, Dr. Ray Bakke, about his perspective on the contemporary religious right in this country and the alignment of the American Baptist tradition with anti-racist organizing. Ray Bakke has pastored inner-city churches in Seattle and Chicago and has a long history of activism on transportation, housing, incarceration, and other social urban issues. This interview was edited for length and clarity by John Nelson. Here's Jan speaking with Dr. Ray Bakke.
You were a theologian and pastor with the American Baptist Church, and your work centers on what you called urban ministries. You've spoken around the world about a vision that maybe aligned with liberation theology and aligned more with the left, maybe starting with the abortion issue that now is and has been at the center of the religious right for decades as a kind of a symbolic issue for many conservatives. But many historians trace the rise of the religious right as a political force to the anti-desegregation movements of the 60s and the social movements of the 60s. Then initially opposition to abortion was not really on the register of many evangelicals, including Christianity Today, but it became an issue that they could mobilize around. How would you summarize some of the keystone historical forces behind the rise of the religious right?
Right. So Nixon took the Republican Party hard to the right on the race issue. He wanted to outflank George Wallace, who ran on segregation forever. And Nixon basically helped create the flip of the Southern Democratic Party, which became Republican and anti-Black Republican almost overnight following Nixon's impact. And then, of course, the war in Vietnam brought radicals into the street, and Americans were watching long-haired hippie types on TV screaming and yelling at the government. And my reaction listening to my people, rural family members and others, is they were frightened at the visibility of the anti-war movement and the race movement, which was really off their map cognitively and geographically. In 1965, when we moved to Chicago with two preschool kids, we later adopted a Black son. And the truth is, he wouldn't have been able to vote in 14 states in 1965 before the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act. They had ways to keep Blacks away from the polls. And unless you're in Black America at that time, you really, I think, don't know the extent to which this horror had existed, the Jim Crow movement.
What we're seeing now around the country is not new. There's a long, deep, dark history of this.
Yes, I was absolutely stunned to realize how complicit the white church was in all of this. American Baptists split from the Southern Baptists split from the Northern Baptists in 1843 on the slave issue. American Baptists, which were the Northern Baptists, renamed later, have always been progressive. After the Civil War, our home mission secretary with Rockefeller money went down and bought all the land in Southwest Atlanta for the creation of Morehouse and Spelman and Smith and all the other Black colleges.
The historical there. Black yeah. colleges.
He did the same thing in Richmond, Virginia. After the war, he went down and bought the slave auction barn, and the American Baptists started a Black seminary, which is now a college and seminary. So American Baptists were progressively involved on the race question 100 years earlier. And Southern Baptists were those whose economy really depended on Black cheap labor until the 1920s, when finally the cotton gin and other machinery put Black rural voters out of power. And then they came north to get jobs in American cities. And of course, they brought the Black churches with them. So the North in the United States, Black Baptists and American Baptists would be right of center, biblically left of center, and far left of center socially and politically. That's certainly where I am and where my kids are. And it's the politics that I'm comfortable with. I think the other thing that's going on, Jan, around the country is this generation gap is huge. There's an old aphorism, which I believe, that change is always experienced as loss. Even when it's gain, it's experienced as loss.
I think very stressful.
Yeah. When you hear about Islamic terrorists overseas, I think white America truly feels like terrorists abroad are infiltrating us, and they become even more anti. They've not accepted pluralism of the U.S. as a value. And I think the Asianization, the Africanization, Latinization of this country has become visible. And I think since 9/11, it's actually terrifying to many.
But the Tea Party movement of 2011, 2012, that had such a reaction to Obama, to the financial crises, became a much more viscerally angry anti-government politics and a politics of grievance that was invested in dismantling the federal government, which had always been part of the religious right, all the way, of course, back to desegregation, the civil rights movement. But do you think there have been important shifts over time in how the religious right mobilizes people around their grievances?
I agree with Cornel West in his book, Democracy Matters. It's a phrase that is ugly, but he coined it. I'll quote it. The niggardization of white America. He said, for the first time in American history, white people feel fear. They feel vulnerable. We've been a moated country, protected by oceans. Suddenly, 19 people of color from the Arab world attack us and they win. They bring down the business in the Pentagon and pretty close to bringing down the Capitol.
A collective, massive narcissistic injury to this sense of
it changed everything.
Collective invulnerability.
Oh, yes, very much so.
You've also talked about we're all, in a sense, refugees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Christianity was founded, as was Islam and Judaism, on refugee movements. Abraham was a refugee. He was born in Iraq. Today it would be Iraq. And we are cousins. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all Abrahamic faiths, and they have a lot in common. We have more in common than we do with the religions of India, for example, Hinduism, Buddhism. So anyway, right away, Bush started fanning the flames of fear. The they became part of the vocabulary. And it was an appeal to be calm to white people. Hey, we're not losing. We're still in charge here and so on. But I started observing the speeches in which fear was being propagated from the White House in the Bush years. So Bush,
but of course, that was always a cover for other things. And I mean, what many have observed about the Trump era was just how overt the racism has become in the Republican Party.
It became more and more obvious. And of course, Trump fanned the flames of white nationalism from the very beginning. And I really was taken by surprise at the degree to which northern middle-class white congregations would be taken in by this.
And how do you understand that?
I'm trying to understand it. It's obviously the American Christianity is, as one person said, is a mile wide and half an inch deep. It's very shallow understanding of Jesus of Nazareth, as we see Jesus in the Bible, accepting of all people. And, you know, your task as a believer is to love God and then love your neighbor. It's not to hate your neighbor and build a wall around your place. And I mean, neighboring is really at the heart of Christianity. Churches now are fighting over masks. You know, the politicization of things like medicine have just totally shocked me.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts on, I've been very involved in the climate justice movement in recent years and had conversations with progressive young evangelicals who identify with that tradition, who've also talked about the difficulties with a kind of apocalyptic side of the white evangelical tradition, where in a way the end of the world is welcomed Mm-hmm. And every sign of climate chaos or a health crisis or massive death is on a certain level read as a sign of end times. And that's very hard to argue with those people.
Yeah.
How would you assess that part of the religious right that has that kind of theology?
Well, dispensationalism, which was a movement in the 19th century, gave permission to read the Bible in that kind of apocalyptic way. Evangelicalism should know better. It's a total abandonment of Paul in Colossians, who argued that Christ is firstborn of all creation. In him, everything consists. In other words, the church's agenda should be taking on the environment and stewarding. On the abortion question, by the way, let me get to the abortion issue. The Great Lakes is 20% of the world's surface fresh water. It became pretty obvious to me when I was on the Chicago Mayor's Planning Committee in 1980, when Harold Washington was elected, that this water system was being polluted by paint companies and many companies on the shores of these lakes. And Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Toronto, Buffalo, we all drink that water. And there were reports coming out that the impact on unborn babies was huge, that there were sperm count impacts by the pollution on all the water that we were drinking out of Lake Michigan, that in effect, you have mass abortions. And I remember being in a seminar at Wheaton College where I raised the issue and said, I suspect everybody here is against abortion, pretty much. And everybody was. I said, well, here we have a case of possible mass abortion. What texts of scripture would you use to deal with that? And honestly, there were none. They had no doctrine of the creation, and they had forgotten what St. Augustine taught us, that without a robust creation theology, you don't have a redemption theology that's in balance. I go back to the need for a really robust creation theology, which says that we are co-responsible for this environment. It's part of the stewardship that we have on this planet, and it's what we got. We need to take care of it.
My sense is that the issue is really about the sexual pleasure of women separating from being able to separate that from the risk that's always part of sex for women with men, is that you might get pregnant. And it reminds me of my favorite Baptist joke. I want to tell you my favorite Baptist joke, which I'm sure you've heard many times, but I think many people don't understand the deep humor of the joke. And that is, why don't Baptists allow sex before marriage? Well, because it might lead to dancing.
Yeah.
And it's a very funny joke. But I think part of what makes it funny is that dancing in many ways has more to do with sexual pleasure than sex as many conservatives think of it. You know, the missionary position is not called the missionary position for nothing. You know, it's often a very narrow view of sex that limits the pleasure of women and the freedom that comes from separating sex from reproduction. Any thoughts on that? And what's kind of behind the intensity of the anti-abortion crusade?
I'm watching the irony of how dare the government tell me I have to put a needle in my arm and take a shot. At the same time, I'm going to insist that ladies have no say in their abortion of their bodies.
Right. Contradictions abound. That's why it makes you wonder, so what is this really about?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's obviously
keeping the federal government out of the bodies of women has been, you know, a big part of the pro-choice history of campaigns around bodily autonomy.
I lament the cheapenization of sex, whoever and however it's done.
Well, there's the commodifying of sex in commercial culture, but I think the sexual liberation movement that I was part of as a young woman was also about a vision of of freedom for women, of not defining sex entirely around the pleasure of men and mm-hmm. the will of men. Women were expected to regulate access, control access. You know, sex was something women had and men got it from them. And that was certainly a kind of commercial, implicit commercial understanding
The irony is that under Democratic administrations, abortion has gone way, way down.
Yeah, when you have access to education and birth control or contraception.
Right.
Even the way in which the church tradition you're part of embraces gay marriage and women in the clergy. I mean, there have been pretty seismic changes over time. I remember growing up, there was also the fascination of many evangelicals with bad boys and a kind of unconscious pleasure or unacknowledged pleasure in people like that, even though they were brought under the discipline and, of course, of the church, ultimately brought to the altar. But a lot, you know, more kind of fascination with that side of life. I think Trump had a kind of charismatic hold through his recklessness and the way he treated people, and of course, the racism, but also his. Did he tap into, in a sense, a kind of defiance in among conservatives?
I don't like to defend Trump at any level.
No, I'm not defending Trump. Yeah. I'm trying to understand his appeal.
He turned relationships into hostility. He attacked people. You know, all of the so-called niceties of society have been multiplied now by kids who brutally treat other kids. Teachers who testify that the violence in their classrooms, the violence on school buses, has accelerated dramatically during the Trump years and what followed. The harvest of his recklessness will abound. I'm just appalled at the failure of people to get vaccinated. People who think that, you know, they somehow are doing a favor by making themselves vulnerable and then having to get sick. And then use the government to bail you out because, you know, all of that government subsidy is going to COVID victims in hospitals.
I think there is a knowing creation of a crisis and wanting the federal government to fail in these big projects.
That's part of it. I have no doubt about that. So we've got a lot of issues with a lot of justice issues involved.
Yeah, we've got our work cut out for us still.
I do think that keeping family in dialogue is really important. And I believe that it takes effort and sacrifice to do that. And I think we should keep it going. I realize it's harder and harder to do. I think in some ways, the Black church that I know from my experience as a Black dad for 42 years in Chicago, I would want to say to the white, young, progressive, non-religious communities of today, take a fresh look at the Black church. See the power of the of King, for example, who was the product of the Black church. The Voting Rights Act, which is being discussed today in Congress, really is a product of the Black church in many ways. So I'm honored by my friends in the Black tradition because they remind white Americans that we shouldn't give up on the church. I cringe when people talk about the Baptists, for example, as though we're all one.
Clearly you are not. I mean, it's an interesting history, of 150 years of struggle and difference. But then perhaps there's the question, too, of how Baptists have bridged their own differences over time that are very difficult right now in this country to, in many ways, as you said, to have conversations with people who are Trump supporters, for example, or opposed to vaccines. So, Ray, thank you so much again for taking the time, and you've certainly held forth on many topics, even though you've been struggling with health issues, and I appreciate that so much.
I'm gonna let
was a little bit of Fannie Lou Hamer singing This Little Light of Mine. Before that, we heard Jan Hocken speaking with Baptist theologian Ray Bakke about the religious right. And now, to amplify Dr. Bakke's remarks about the important contributions of the Black Church to progressive organizing, we're going to play a short clip of remarks from 2004 by Jesse Jackson about the Martin Luther King organizing vision. Reverend Jackson was on this occasion the guest at a University of Pennsylvania forum hosted by Dr. Tukufu Zuberi, whom you will hear posing a question to Reverend Jackson.
What is the significance of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy for social justice today in the United States and the world? Reverend Jackson, I believe you spent the last birthday that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had alive, and so you might be able to offer us some particularly unique insights in that way. Does it suggest how we ought to strive to make this a better world, that is, the celebration of his legacy? What does this struggle mean for people of African descent?
On January 15, 1968, around 8 o'clock that morning, he had breakfast with his family. He had convened a national staff meeting. Around 10 o'clock, we met in the basement of his church. He had on his windbreaker jacket, blue jeans. A few whites there from Appalachia, some Cesar Chavez group there from Southwest Texas, some Jewish allies, Al Lowenstein group out of New York, some Native Americans, some blacks from Marks, Mississippi, and Deep South, and labor. A kind of multiracial rainbow coalition of sorts, focusing on a job on income for every American, health care and education, organizing a mass action march to Washington to engage in civil disobedience, come by train, by car, by plane, and set up camp in front of Lincoln Memorial because the Emancipation Proclamation promise had been broken. A mass action to Washington. Had to be called multicultural because he knew that that was not going to be a day when you had black full employment, didn't have brown full employment, or white full employment, didn't have brown full employment. So it had to be a multiracial base driven by a shared interest, a job and income for every American. He knew full well most poor people were not black, they were white, female, and young. He had to get beyond the fears of whites who tend to vote their fears rather than their interests. And for the hopes of blacks with despair. So it was 10 to about 1 on how to challenge government policy. Around 1 o'clock, Janona Clayton brought on a cake. We stopped him for about an hour. So we knew it was his birthday. Only we knew, really. Then from 2 to 5, we spent on how to end the war in Vietnam. We spent the monies that were designed for the war on poverty to go into war in Vietnam. So spent his own birthday, A, at home with family, be organizing a coalition for direct action, mass action, and how to end the war in Vietnam. So those who were there honor him on that day must be found somewhere planning how to eliminate poverty, how to end wars, and how to make our economy work for all of its people. That's how he spent his own last birthday.
And so you think the significance is in that, what we ought to do to celebrate that birthday?
Well, because his legacy is what? His legacy is mass action, A, unlike any leader before him. It's mass sacrifice. He was jailed 23 to 26 times, stabbed before he was killed. His impact was to change laws. No other leader changed laws. The 64 Public Accommodations Bill, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Open Housing Act, mass action, body of sacrifice, and changing of laws puts him in a category all unto himself.
That was Reverend Jesse Jackson about organizing and sacrificing to change the rules by which we live in order to benefit everyone rather than privileging the few. That's it for our show today. You are tuned to listener-supported community radio in Portland. 80% of our funding comes from listeners like you, but only 10% of you are members. Please consider joining the KBOO community by becoming a monthly sustainer at whatever level you can afford. Two lucky donors during this drive will be selected by lottery to win a print of one of Betty Lee's photos. To view the photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. This photo giveaway is sponsored by the Old Mole Variety Hour. To donate, go to kboo.fm/give, or you can click on Donate in our mobile app, or text KBOO to 44321, or send a check by snail mail to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Larry Bolden for their contributions this morning, and John Nelson for his editing assistance, and our guests Al Weinrub and Ray Bakke. A big thanks always to the hardworking KBOO staff. I'm going to leave you today with one more song by Madeline Peyrou, one of my favorites, entitled The Brand New Deal. Thanks for listening, and catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m.
Yes, it's fun when you're young beneath an innocent sun, and the unicorns play in the fields, and your daddy drives slow with his Cadillac soul, big strong hands on the wheel. And life's a dream, a serene machine that all seem to care how you feel. And then you grow up and it's never enough, and money is just something to steal. It's every man for himself, so grab the wealth, feel the poor under your heel. It's a brand new deal,
a brand new deal.